What's up, folks? This is Tony Brewer. You're listening to, or watching as the case may be, Cogitations. Cogitations is the podcast where we think about things, we contemplate them, we turn them over in our minds, and then we discuss them. Daniel chapter 7, verse 28, Daniel writes, "Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me. My countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart." Now, we're not going to keep the matter in our heart. We're going to talk about it. And today we're going to talk about the importance of Christian spouses. And this is a topic, quite frankly, that gets all kinds of heat. I remember years ago I was doing a podcast with a person and we were live and we were talking about this subject and we were imploring parents, as you're training up your child in the way they should go, be mindful of how you teach them how to select a mate. Because one of the greatest indicators of success is having a mate. For instance, in the United States of America, there are three things you can do that all but guarantees you will not be impoverished, that you will be successful. Graduate high school, get married, don't have a baby before you're married. I think those are the exact three. I may have split one into two. It could be graduate high school, don't have a baby out of wedlock, and get married or get a job. It doesn't matter. The point is that one thing, choosing the right spouse, that can make or break. If you choose the wrong spouse, your life is ruined. More so, actually, if you're a man. Because if you choose the wrong spouse and a woman, you're going to be married 5-10 years. You've chosen the wrong spouse. The marriage dissolves. And now you are on the hook for thousands of dollars, in some cases, per month. And you're basically castrated for the rest of your life. It's difficult. Very difficult. So we've got to choose the right spouse. Now, what is the easiest way to choose the right spouse if you're a Christian? Only date or court, whatever you want to call it, within your faith, Christians. There is not a direct commandment, an explicit commandment that prohibits marrying outside of the Christian faith. We will talk about 2 Corinthians 6 in this podcast. And we will pull a general principle that can be applied to this, but I must stress, if you are married to a spouse that is not a Christian, or if you marry a spouse that is not a Christian, you have not committed sin in and of itself. That act in and of itself is not sinful. In other words, if it were the case that marrying a non-Christian were sinful, the only way you could repent of that is that you would be in control of is to divorce that spouse. Well, we know that's not the case. That's ludicrous. Now, you could convert your spouse, but you have no control over that. So you would be in sin until they converted or you divorce them, because that's how you repent of a marriage that isn't recognized in the eyes of God. Anyway, let's get into everything. Hello, everybody. How you doing? Good morning, Scott Beck, Terry Crooks, Diana Harden. Folks, it is here. The day has arrived. If you will look on your comment section, I'm going to put it there one more time. I have a link to the Shopify store. This is not been cheap to do. It has cost a great amount of time. It's cost a little bit of money. And we're thankful that that's you folks who support us. This is the fruit of your support. The advertisement that we're able to do to grow the channel, being able to have these designs and do this store and everything. And the store is not finished, as in it's going to be viscous is not the right word. It's going to be growing and changing. It's going to ebb and flow. We're going to be testing these designs and these products, and if we don't like them, we're gonna nix them. But what I have shared in the comments section is, well, wait a second. Well, that's Podbean. Hold on. Let me go here. All right. Now, copy. Now we're cooking with hot butter. There it is. Christianity Now, my shop. This is a jumbo 20-ounce coffee mug, and I have it marked down to where it is $15.01, and that is not very much more than what we pay for it. And the way this works is whenever you place this order, this Shopify communicates with a print-on-demand shop. They print it and they ship it. And if you're in the United States, this ships from the United States. I've ordered me one of these cups. It is on its way. I had to pay like $14 shipping to get it to Canada. But this is based in the United States, so you won't be paying a whole lot for it. I did test this out. I ordered a shirt and had it sent to the United States to Aaron Dotson. And so it's on its way. So this is absolutely working. One of you that are listening, I owe a shirt. You will get that. I figured this out, and I did not realize that I could go all the way back and get something like that. But anyway, I'm kind of excited. So remember, if you want to support us and you want value back for your support, go to the Christianity Now Shopify store. You can go there just simply by clicking on the link that I put in the comments section, ChristianityNow.myShopify, which I don't know. Just click the link and explore the store. And that's a way you can support us and get something in return that's tangible. It's branded. We got a lot of neat stuff. And that's it. We'll have other things in the future, like I can do a discount codes, and like I'm thinking about doing a discount code like Maslow Rocks, so you can have a discount off of your order if you type in Maslow Rocks, and we'll have a promotion where we do that. Remember, if I say some stupid thing that you think would be funny on a shirt, I still want to do the shirt. We need to sit at Jesus' feet, not in his seat, and then have a picture of a version of Jesus Christ sitting on a throne and a human being kneeling at his feet. It's just in the future. Scott Beck says, thank you. I look forward to shopping. Awesome. And the Sword and Pearl, hello all. Good to see you, Sword and Pearl. So let's get into this. Your life will be much better if you pick a spouse that shares your values. I don't care what religion you are. I don't care if you're an atheist. I don't care anything. If you are a diehard Alabama fan, like football, Roll Tides, your life is going to be better off and there's going to be less friction if you marry somebody who is a diehard Alabama fan. Because they're going to share your same values. Come game day, they're going to be like, yes, have the guys over. Let's have a party, this, that, and the other. We're going to watch the game. Where if they're not a diehard Alabama fan, then they're going to think that's silly. Or if they're rooting for your rivals, if they're diehard, I don't know, Auburn fans, then you might have some friction. Now, you might be thinking, Tony, that's rather silly because, you know, that's football silly, and I know a lot of people that root for different teams on game day. Well, I understand that. And that's a little frivolous, but if we can see it there in the micro, then we should be able to visualize it in the macro. And I like what Ben Shapiro says when he talks about picking a spouse. How many children do you want? How are you going to discipline your children? What religion are your children going to be? What values are you going to instill on your children? Do you want to be a stay-at-home mom? Do you want to be a stay-at-home dad? Do you want a private school, homeschool, public school? Whatever. All of this stuff. When is the proper time to discuss that? My suggestion is do it on the first date. Like, do it way, way earlier as opposed to later. Here's the thing. What courting should be, what dating should be, it should be a way for young people to get to know one another and know their values so they can figure out whether or not they will be compatible. And then once they figure out whether or not they are compatible, then they can allow themselves to be open and vulnerable and allow a romantic relationship to grow. But there should be much logic on the front end and much logic on the back end during the relationship building process. In the middle, that's where all your lovey-dovey, butterfly-in-the-stomach, romantic-type stuff should fall. So, how should this go? Well, I'm 16 years old. I meet a girl. And I'm a man, so I'm teaching from a man's perspective. I'm 16 years old. I meet a girl. Hey, how are you doing? I rather like you, and I'd like to take you out for coffee. Can you, Saturday, can I pick you up, and we can go to the coffee shop, and we can maybe drink some coffee and eat some lunch or something? Well, sure. And so you pick that girl up, and you take her to the coffee shop, and y'all drink coffee, and maybe she orders her coffee a certain way. That tells you something about her. You talk to her. Talk to her about the future. You're like, what are your future plans? Ask her about herself. Ask her what she likes, what she dislikes. And be upfront and transparent. Don't hide the ball. This culture has, at least I think it still does, promote a kind of recreational dating. In other words, I'm going to play the field until I'm ready to settle down. No, you need to be taught that once you become a certain age, 16, 17, 18 years old, it's time to settle down. There should be no, like, we don't call it this, but in the church, we have a rumspringa, like the Amish do. Yes, well, you know, we're going to send them off to college after high school, and they're going to get out there, and they're going to experience the world, and they're going to find themselves, they're going to make mistakes, and then they'll come back to God because, you know, if you train up a child in the way he should go, when he's old, he will not depart from it. So if you've done your job as a parent, mom and daddy, and you let them kids go out there for their rumspringa, they will come back. How long, and I don't like quoting from denominational teachers, but I'll quote this one. How long are we going to send our children to be educated by Rome and be surprised when they come back acting like Romans and not Christians? Think about that. So, the point is, we need to change the value system in the Lord's church. Remember, judgment starts at the house of God. So we look inward, we change our value system, and we start telling our young men and women, hey, it's 16, 17 years old. Yeah, you need to be thinking about your future. One of the greatest tricks the devil ever pulled is not convincing the world he doesn't exist. It's not convincing the world that, I'll tell you what it's convincing the world of. It's convincing the world that they have plenty of time. And we tell this to young people, and so we rob a young man and a young woman, sometimes as much as 15 years of relationship building and wealth building, and we have our children start their adult life behind the eight ball, as it were. True that. I'd love to be a stay-at-home mom and teach the kids. Absolutely. And the sad thing is, and I want to get Hey Hey Alabama's comment. But sadly, what most young people were taught by the generation that raised me, I'm 46, so from about 30 to 40, 45, thereabouts, that generation was taught that you need to focus on self, you need to make sure that you have all the experiences that you want to experience out of the way. And you've got plenty of time to settle down, to pick a mate, and to start a family, and to find a career. And the answer is you don't. You do not have plenty of time. We live 100 years. We're just going to break it down in 20. The first 20 is figuring out who we are. The second 20 ought to be wealth building, relationship building, family building. And in the next 20, you can enjoy yourself. Just maintenance, stability. And then the next 20 is your golden years. And you can sit back. You can enjoy all the little babies. You can enjoy traveling. You can do all of that. But the problem is that generation that reared my generation from about 30 to 45, they rob the young people of about 10 to 15 years of that. They rob an entire season of their lives. That's it, Facebook user. Redeem the time. Parents make a big mistake by not putting their children in local junior college first. They have no idea how to be on their own. Absolutely. And sadly, hey, Alabama, they wouldn't need to do that if we would go back to how things were done in the good old days, like in the 80s and 90s. If we would go back to how things were done then, you know, you had kids, like I remember at 17 years old, I was gone out of my house. Now, I was functioning at a deficit because my parents did the best they could with what they had. They just didn't have much as far as ability and how to deal with me. I was a special case. I was adopted. I had excessive and extreme childhood trauma. I was rebellious. They couldn't control me at all. No matter what they did, they could whoop me. They could ground me. They could take privileges away or anything. Basically, they could make my life a world of excrement. And I just take it in stride because you can't make my life a world of excrement any worse than what I feel like it already is. Now, I'm not saying that I was right. I'm just saying that's the way I felt. And I'm not saying that they were nefarious or bad. I'm just saying it is what it is. But I left at 17. Now, I did come back for about 8 months and live in my old room to save on rent whenever my job took me back to Northwest Tennessee. Because I'm like, you know, why do I go out and why am I going to go rent and pay, you know, $500 or $600 a month for some place to live when I've got a free place to live right here? There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, here in Canada, my 21-year-old, well, he's going to be 21 in about 19 days. My 21-year-old son lives here with me. But he lives here with me. He and I live, like, in other words, he's really not a dependent anymore, although we're allowed to claim him on taxes. But anyway, I've got way far off the subject. Hey, Alabama, my dad was out of the house at 15. She also goes on to say, stop keeping them infants until they turn 18 and expect them to know stuff. That's the ticket right there, sister. And Facebook user says, my oldest is in her first year of college, and now I'm seeing all the things I should have done differently. Yeah, welcome to the club. I have the way I deal with that personally, and I didn't mean to dismiss, like, well, welcome to the club. That comment resonated with me. When I look back on my life and all the mistakes that I've made and all the things that I could have done differently, one huge thing I have to latch hold of that I know I did right, and that's the spiritual training of my children. Now, there's stuff with my children I wish I'd have done differently, that I should have done differently. But I can at least I'm going to take some godly pride and some assurance that with the help of very good people around me, you know, my wife, and quite frankly, my parents, we were able to really rear our children well as far as their spirituality is concerned. They're well-adjusted children. They could live on their own. They're not children. They're adults. They could live on their own. They have, and in fact, I don't know what's going to happen once we get permanent residence and all that good stuff. because Anthony is talking about maybe going back to the States and buying a house and this, that, and the other. Abigail, she wants to go to school here, and it's once we get permanent residence, it's going to be like really, really, really cheap to go to the community college. But yeah, that's so you have done something, even though you're seeing all the quote unquote all the things that you should have done differently. I promise, if you look back on your rearing of your children, you can latch hold of something that you did 100% right that could have been done no better by anyone. So take comfort in that. Scott Beck says, I feel for the young adults in our congregation. They aren't many dating candidates for them to choose from. Scott Beck, absolutely. Which, incidentally, it's why we need to normalize that's why we need to normalize purposeful courtship and normalize the parents getting involved in things. Because let me tell you, let's say that you've got a 16-year-old girl at the congregation where you attend, and there's no boys that are her age. And when I say her age, I mean she's 16. A courtship candidate could be all the way up to 25. Now that doesn't now from a worldly standard, that sounds like pedophilic, but it's not, because when she's 18, that man will only be 28. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, there's nothing wrong with a husband being about 10 years older than a spouse, than a wife. That's it. We can all have done better with some things, but we didn't do as bad as we think. You got that right, hey, Alabama. You got that right. But the point is, what her parents may know somebody two or three towns over, and they say, well, we got four boys here that are between the ages of 16 and 22 that are perfect candidates for her courtship. And incidentally, when you take premarital sex off of the table, there's nothing. I mean, what's the difference between a 16-year-old and a 19-year-old? When you take sex off of the table. Remember, we need to normalize teaching purity to our young men and women. You do not have sex before marriage. You don't. The problem is, sex is what kissing on the lips used to be 50 years ago. Used to, and well, back whenever I was coming up, if a girl let you kiss her on the first date, she is kind of considered a slut. Now, kissing is just, or having sex is the same as kissing. Folks, we got to help our young people. This is difficult. And we got to normalize saving yourself for marriage. We got to normalize dating with a purpose, courtship with a purpose. And we got to normalize getting the adults involved in their lives and helping with the matchmaking system. You ought to look at I don't have them at hand, but you ought to look at the statistics for successful marriages in the Jewish community. Do you know all of those Jewish grandmamas, if they meet somebody that's single, they start listing other people off like, oh, I know this, I know this person, I know that person, I know that person. They'd be perfect for you. What's wrong with that? Why don't we do that? Anyway, just something to think about. And incidentally, talking about there aren't many dating candidates for them to choose from, that's why we need to teach our young men, hey, you don't need to take a few years of Rumspringa to find yourself. You need to grow up. You need to be responsible. You need to set yourself up and make yourself have the ability to be able to take care of a family from a very early age. Teach them responsibility. Teach them to be grave, sober, vigilant, diligent. Teach them all those qualities. Teach them how to be masculine in a godly way. And then our women, and this is a hard one for women to hear. Women need to stop listening to other women give them advice about men. I'm going to repeat that. Women need to stop listening to other women about dating and relationships and advice about men. Generally speaking, I'm not saying that there's some woman in the church where you are that gives advice. I'm not saying that she doesn't give sage advice. I'm not saying don't listen to her personally. I'm just saying, generally speaking, the worst advice that is out there for young women comes from other women. Stop it. If you want to know, if you're 16 years old and you don't have any responsible adults in your life and you want to know what men want, go to a man that's my age that's been married for 25 years and say, what do men want in a wife? What women in general tell young women is, oh, you need to be self-possessed. You need to be able to be take care of yourself. You need to be independent, a free thinker, this, that, and the other. And they're describing a man. Men don't want to marry other men. Let me break this down real easy. If you're listening to this and you're a young woman, or maybe you have a young woman in your life that is seeking advice on what men want and how to make herself the best candidate for marriage that she can be to a high-value man that's able to take care of her, that's able to wife her up where she only has to work if she really wants to, men want a young, pure virgin with zero debt and no tattoos. And if you'll notice, I did not describe physical beauty. I didn't say on a scale of 1 to 10, she has to be a dime. They want a woman that is unencumbered by the baggage of the world. Women have their value that is intrinsic to them. They're born with it, and it needs to be preserved. Men, their value is not intrinsic to them. Men are only valued for what they can provide. That's the way God set it up. It may sound brutal. I don't really care. A man's value has to be earned. A woman's value has to be preserved. And what we are teaching our young women for the last about three generations is you need to cast off every godly virtue, every value that you have as a woman, and you need to eschew that. And you need to be independent, strong-willed, a boss babe. You need to find yourself a good job so you can have your own career. And then by the time you're ready to settle down, you have $200,000, $100,000 in debt from going to college. You have gone through what is normally called a hoe phase, your rumspringa, where you've given yourself to some men. And then because you're not living according to your actualized self, you have high anxiety and neuroticism, and you've got weird colored hair, you've got tattoos and this, that, and the other, and you are no longer worth as much as you were. Your prime years for rearing a family has been robbed from you because you didn't go God's route. I told my daughter she can do anything a man can do, and now she's a diesel mechanic. Well, that's good, but and take this in the spirit in which it's intended. There is no woman on the face of the earth that can do everything a man can do. Yeah, she can be a diesel mechanic, and that's a field that is not typically dominated or not where there's not a lot of women. But women in general, they cannot fulfill the role of men. Men and women are, in fact, not equal. In other words, you cannot substitute a man for a woman or a woman for a man. And that is what the zeitgeist has manifested into this demon that walks the earth and devours our young women. Because it tells them, you are no different than a man. And it tells men, you are no different than a woman. So what has happened? Well, we have a bunch of feminine men and we have a bunch of masculine women. I've just bummed myself out. Good grief. So all of this, that is why choosing a Christian spouse, if you're a Christian, is important. Because if not, you're going to be fighting these battles all the time. I go back to Exodus chapter 34. In fact, we just studied this past Sunday, and I think it's very interesting. Let's read some. Exodus 34. I'm going to start reading in verse 10 because it's important for the context. And he said, behold, I make a covenant before all thy people. I will do marvels such as have not been done in all the earth, nor in any nation, and all the people among which thou art shall see the works of the Lord, for it is a terrible thing that I will do with thee. Observe thou that which I command thee this day. Behold, I drive out before thee the Amorite and the Canaanite, the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite. Take heed to thyself, lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, whither thou goest, lest it be for a snare in the midst of thee. But ye shall destroy their altars, and break their images, and cut down their groves. For thou shalt worship no other god, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. Lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they go a-whoring after their gods, and do sacrifice unto their gods, and one call thee, and thou eat of his sacrifice. And thou take their daughters unto thy sons, and their daughters go a-whoring after their gods, and make thy sons go a-whoring after their gods. Thou shalt make thee no molten gods. So God, through Moses, is saying, look, observe and do this which I command of thee. Drive out all of the inhabitants of the land, smash their altars, cut down their groves. I'm going to do this. I'm going to help you. I'm going to be with you. And this is not arbitrary. The seed promise, Jesus has to come from the line of Judah. We have to keep the line of Judah pure. We cannot dilute the seed of God's people with the seed of the world. Now, this does not come over to the New Testament because we have the seed here. The genealogies are destroyed. There's no more reason to keep an ethnic line pure. But the principle, if you as a Christian, if you're a young man, I'm teaching from a man's perspective. If you're a young man and you find yourself in a courtship relationship with a woman who does not share your faith, you're barring trouble. You're begging for it. The chance that she will lead you astray is exponentially greater than if you were courting a woman who shared your faith. There is a cautionary tale. 1 Kings, let's go to that. Chapter 11. Everybody knows who I'm going to be talking about. And this is really sad. Listen. But King Solomon loved many strange women together with the daughter of the Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and the Hittites. Of the nations concerning which the Lord said to the children of Israel, ye shall not go unto them, neither shall they come into you, for surely they will turn your way your heart after their gods. Solomon clave unto these in love. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For it came to pass, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. That is absolutely sad. I'm thinking, there's another. I'm thinking of chapter. Let me see some. Yeah. Listen to this. This is 1 Kings 3, verse 3. And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in all the statutes of David his father. Only he sacrificed and burnt incense in high places. How sad is that? Why did Solomon? Solomon could have followed in the footsteps of his father David. And he did, for the most part, but one thing. He sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places. Why did he do that? Because his heart was turned away because of these strange women. This is a cautionary tale. Young woman, what do you think the chances are of you remaining faithful in Christ, choosing a spouse that's not a Christian? How long do you think you can function in faith through that friction? Hide and watch. Almost 20 years into being unevenly yoked, it makes everything harder than it needs to be. That's the thing. We could stop the podcast now. How much easier would it be if the husband and the wife were on the same page as far as faith goes? Everything is harder than it needs to be. Because you just have two different worldviews. You have two different frames of reference. All right. So let's talk about the theological implications of choosing the right spouse. Well, there is a call to holiness. Now, everything that we're about to talk about is general principle, okay? I've got to repeat, you are not in violation of the law of the new covenant if you have a spouse that's not a Christian, okay? All of this is generally speaking. This is a principle. Leviticus chapter 19, we're going to go to the Old Testament here, but I think it's worth looking at because what can we know about God from Leviticus? Speak unto all the congregation of the children of Israel and say to them, ye shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. And then you're going to read all kinds of things that they are to do that differentiates them from the nations. They can't do these things that differentiate them from the nations if they are in a bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh contract with the nations. Now, think about if you're a man, Christian man, married to a non-Christian woman, or if you're a non-Christian, or if you're a Christian woman married to a non-Christian man. Every time you have to participate and act in ways that separate you and differentiate you from the world, the person with whom you are in a bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh contract is going to be pulling against that and working against that. How long can you keep that up? If your spouse decides to leave the faith, keep going. It makes things difficult too. Yeah, that's a good point, hey, Alabama. If both of you are Christians and your spouse decides to leave the faith, if you remain faithful, it makes it hard for them to leave the faith. It creates friction on their leaving. That's one reason why, well, Ecclesiastes, I can't remember the verse off the top of my head, but you can find it. A threefold cord is not easily broken. Now, think about who are the participants in a bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh contract? There's three, folks. God, man, woman. All right? So if all three of you are on the same page, then you're all three together in everything. But what if you're only on the same page in a few things? Well, that leaves a vulnerability for the devil to come in and break things up. That leaves a vulnerability for the devil to come in and drive a wedge. If the man and the woman are both Christians, they're in a covenant relationship with God through their faith and through the marriage, the devil's going to have to work mighty, mighty hard to find a vulnerable spot in which to insert his wedge to break things up. First Peter chapter 1. Let's go there. So we are called to be separate, to do things that are differentiate ourselves from the world. First Peter chapter, 15 and 16. Couldn't find it for a minute. But as he which hath called you is holy, so be ye holy in all manner of conversation, because it is written, be ye holy, for I am holy. Sorry, some weird noise going on in the background. That's it. Just be holy. Why? Well, because God that called you is holy. So that's the theological implication. Just very cut and dry. If you're a woman and you marry a non-Christian man, if you're a Christian man and you marry a non-Christian woman, you're going to have friction. Theologically, it's going to be more difficult for you to separate yourself from the world. But let's talk about some practical applications. Well, think about, well, first off, I want to go to Malachi. Again, I know I'm going to the Old Testament a lot, but remember, for whatsoever things written aforetime, written for our learning, that we, through patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. Malachi chapter 2, verse 15. And did he not make you one? And did he not make one? Yet had he the residue of the Spirit, and wherefore one? That he might seek a godly seed. Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth. The context here is that God, through the prophet Malachi, is telling the people, look, you've dealt treacherously with the wife of your youth. Go all the way back to verse 11 of Malachi chapter 2. Judah hath dealt treacherously, and an abomination is committed in Israel and in Jerusalem, for Judah hath profaned the holiness of the Lord, which he loved, and hath married the daughter of a strange god. Hide and watch. Hide and watch. You may have entered. You may have hit enter too early. If C. So the nation of Israel joined itself to another nation. And God is saying, look, you've dealt treacherously with the wife of your youth. Why is it so important for you not to intermarry with the nations round about? Because we got to keep the seed line pure. You have dealt treacherously. We need to have a shared faith foundation in a marriage. That's why a godly spouse is important. Let's go to Ephesians 5. Let's go to 22. Listen to this. Wives, submit yourselves to your own husband as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be subject to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church, and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so in this manner love his wife even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband, folks. Hey, hide and watch says, sorry. No, I was curious about your comment. This is what I was talking about, and I didn't mean to say anything that would make you think you needed to apologize. I was just sad that if you had a thought, it didn't get out there. So why did we take the time to read this text? Our life will go so much smoother and have a lot less problems if we have the same foundation of faith. Ladies, would it not be much easier to submit to your husband as you would unto the Lord if he were a godly man? Men, would it not be much easier to love your wife as Christ loved the church if she were a godly woman? I want to tell you, I'm 46 years old. My wife and I were married in December 11th of 1999. That means this year, December 11th, we're going to be married, what, 24 years? 25? Yeah, 25 years. Is that right? Yeah. No. I don't know. We've been married a while. I am overwhelmed sometimes at the emotion, the love that I feel for this woman. And I love her for her godly attributes. I love her because she loves me. I love her because she reveres me. She acts very lovingly, so that's why I love her. Plus, it helps that we made a vow before God and witnesses that we would, because we don't love each other like that every day. If anyone is considering marriage with a non-Christian, feel free to reach out to me. I won't sugarcoat anything Hide and Watch says. Let me tell you something, I appreciate that, and I would recommend it. Look, if you're a parent, if you're a set of parents and you have a young man or a young woman that's considering courtship or dating, and you're trying to warn them against dating outside of the Christian faith, look up Hide and Watch. Send them a message. Or go talk to somebody that is in that situation and say, would your life be improved? Or what's the opposite of improved? Worsened if you had a spouse that was shared the same faith. So Deuteronomy 6:6-7, this idea, well, let's just go back to Deuteronomy. Everybody knows this Deuteronomy passage, but I don't think it hurts none to read it. Deuteronomy 6:6-7. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and they shall be as a frontlet between thine eyes. And thou shalt write them upon the post of thy house and thy gates, and it shall be, when the Lord thy God shall have brought thee into the land which he sware unto thy fathers, so on and so forth. Folks, if you're going to train up a child, and your goal should be to train up a child that whenever he's old enough or she's old enough to reach the age of accountability, they obey the gospel, how much more difficult would that be to do if you were the only one doing it? Scott Beck, we had an older couple in the church. She was a Christian. He wasn't. She worked on him for 30 years, and he was finally baptized. No telling how hard she worked and prayed for him to be saved. Amen. And you know what? And I know you're not doing it for this reason, but this is a good segue into making this next point. I am so happy that testimony is hers. But you alluded to, like no telling how hard she had to work and how diligently she prayed. In other words, it was a lot of work. It was a lot of trouble. How much better would it have been for her to be married to a spouse, a Christian spouse in the first place? And ladies, this is for you young women. I tell my daughter this because if my daughter finds a mate here in Canada, he's not going to be a Christian when they meet. But what I tell her, if some boy works up the nerve to ask you out, say, sure, we can go out our first date. Meet me here at the Riverview Church of Christ. Make him court you through your Christian family. If he doesn't want to do that, he's not the guy. And if he does want to do that, then you court him as long as you feel like he's willing to listen And the minute he says, you know what, this Christianity is good for you, but I'd love to date you. I'd love to, you know, maybe even build a life with you, but I'll never be a Christian. And he doesn't have to articulate that in those words. You're going to know it. Then as hard as it might be, you got to cut him loose. And it's better to know sooner than later because guess what? Ladies, young men, young women, you're running up against a clock. All marriage have some issues, even when you share core beliefs. You're just asking to multiply those issues by multitudes by not sharing core beliefs. That fact alone ought to be enough to convince people of the gravity of this situation. Marriage is hard anyway. Why double down on the difficulty? Now, mutual understanding and commitment. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Let's go here. Now, many of my brethren have a false idea of the finality of 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Listen to this. I am going to do verse 14, and I'm just going to read to the end of the chapter. I'm going to make a point here about how strong of a commandment this is. So if this is talking about unequally yoked in marriage, then hide and watch would be in sin for being married to a non-Christian and would have to repent of that sin and bring forth fruit meet for repentance. How in the world could she do that? You'd have to dissolve the marriage. Is that really what Jesus is teaching? Or is that really what the Apostle Paul is teaching here? Well, no. Let's read it. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship hath the righteousness with unrighteous, and what communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what part hath he that believeth with an infidel? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For ye are the temple of the living God. As God hath said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. Because of this, come out from among them. So here's the remedy in the text. If unequally yoked can be applied to a marriage, then the remedy for that is to come out from among them. Wherefore, come out from among them, be ye separate, saith the Lord. Touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you. So, if it is the case that this is talking about a marriage, then the only way for you to be received of God is for you to touch not that unclean thing. The unclean thing would be your spouse there. There's just one problem. When you read 1 Corinthians chapter 7, we know that when a non-Christian is married to a Christian, the spouse is sanctified by the believing spouse. In other words, in relation to the marriage, evidently, the spouse is not unclean in relation to the marriage. So this bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, so therefore neither are the children unclean. But if being unevenly yoked is referring to marriage, then the only remedy for being unequally yoked is to divorce. And that's not what Paul is saying at all. This is talking about the fellowship of a false teacher. In other words, don't sit at the feet of false teachers. Don't be in fellowship with false teachers. Don't go rub elbows with known false teachers. Don't put your stamp of approval on what they say and do. But we will apply the general principle to a marriage because think about how much influence your spouse has on you. Now, for the next very few minutes, I want to talk about this statistic that is often cited. When dad comes to Christ first, 93% of families will follow. When mom comes to Christ first, 17% of families will follow. When kids come to Christ first, 3.5% of families will follow. The conclusion is the father, the man, has the most influence on the home. Well, there's just one problem. This this statistic is apocryphal in nature because, well, let me just read this. So there are two possible sources for this statistic. I'm going to read you some here. I was able to locate two possible sources for the 93% statistic by finding a few articles that included a source citation. A few websites attribute the data to original Promise Keepers movement of the late 1990s, with at least one claiming the source of a study by Promise Keepers and Baptist Press. However, I can find no evidence of such study. Moreover, Promise Keepers online, resources don't reference the statistic at all, which seems odd if the data is a result from one of their studies. A few websites mention or footnote the Promise Keepers at Work, a group study resource published in 1996, and actually named the Promise Keepers at Work, and this book includes a reflection question in a sidebar. And here it is, open quote, "Consider this, when a child is the first to attend church, 3.5% of families follow. When a wife or mom is the first to attend church, 17% of families follow. When a dad and husband is the first to attend church, 93% of families follow." The study guide does not provide a source for the data, nor does it claim to have conducted a study. There is no other reference to this information, its source, or the means by which it was obtained in the study guide. I was able to contact one of the book's authors, and he does not recall all the source of the information, or he does not recall the source of the information. The authors of the book were on staff at Campus Crusade for Christ, which also does not claim to have conducted the study and does not cite the statistic in their current resources. So it doesn't bode well for the accuracy of the study. The other possible source is the demographic characteristics of national minorities in certain European cities, a study conducted in Switzerland in 1994. This citation appears on at least one Catholic website, and I was also directed to a study in the comments on social media posts that shared the 93% claim. A reference librarian tracked down the study for me, and it includes a brief section addressing the continuity or discontinuity of church attendance across generations. So I wanted to be very, very transparent and open here and not use a study that's considered bunk. That being said, I think it's just fine to, in an a priori, to make an a priori argument here. Like, we can look around and see when the man is a Christian, the chances are exponentially higher that the family will follow. I think we need to be careful citing this study, but I think we can believe our own eyes. We can believe the anecdotes of our own lives, and we got a bunch of people together. We can talk about, well, who do you know that's in marriages where only the wife is a Christian? Very often the children do not grow up to be faithful. And then you have 10 generations that are not Christians. What happens whenever the man is a Christian and the wife is not? Very often, in many cases, the man falls away and nobody in that family is a Christian. But at least on a much higher level, the wife is converted. What about, though, when the man and the woman both are Christians? Very often, the children grow up to be Christians. If things are done right, our retention rate in the Lord's church is much higher than the retention rate of denominations. Folks, that's why it's so important to pick your spouse, because you're not just picking somebody you're going to live with the rest of your life. You're going to be picking the father or mother of your children, the grandmother or grandfather of your grandparents, and you're going to be picking the person that's going to be trying to help you or hinder you to get to heaven. Hide and watch, as I found that most Christians, including myself, that someone considering marriage to a non-Christian isn't really being faithful to a faithful Christian at the time. Hide and watch, that is a brutal statement, but I tend to agree with you. Yeah, friendship with the world is enmity with God. And here's the thing, especially to the young women out there. If you allow a young man to date you and he's not a Christian, he's going to have certain sexual expectations for you of you. And if you don't perform, he's just going to go find somebody that will, because young women that are willing to do that are a dime a dozen. In fact, I put forth to you that in this day and age, the young women are much more perverted sexually than the young men. And I believe I'd stand by that. Terry Crooks, it is beneficial to date someone who shares the same faith, but we must exercise caution in choosing them because some people are merely great pretenders. They want a good spouse to keep up their appearance. Yes, and that's the thing. And that's such a good point to make, and that's a good one to close with. Even if you do everything right, you could still end up with a bum, because there is maliciousness, malevolence in the world. So why beg for trouble? So do everything right. Folks, we've talked about the wisdom in courtship, in courting within the faith, and the long-term problems it could cause. We put 1 Corinthians or 2 Corinthians 6 in its context while still pulling from it a general principle that's germane to our topic. I beg of you, in your area of influence, extol the virtue of finding a Christian spouse and teach these young people, start your life early. Don't wait till you're 35 and think, especially to the women, to the little girls, the 16 years old. No, don't wait till you're 35 to start thinking about marriage and having a baby and this, that, and the other. You're done. 35 is the beginning stages of geriatric pregnancy. It's not quite as, the wall is not quite as troublesome to a man, because men's value in that way goes up as they get older. Sadly, those young women's value in that way, that it goes down as they get older. You know, you got a man who, you know, if you got a man who's 6 foot tall, makes $100,000 a year, he's fit. Let's say he's a Christian. If he's 35, he's not going to marry a 35-year-old woman. He's going to marry a 20-year-old woman. And he's going to marry a 20-year-old woman with no debt, no tattoos, and hasn't been on Rumspringa and sold her wild oats. And he's going to be able to do that because he can have his pick. Folks, that's all I've got here. God bless every one of you. Listen, don't forget, check out the store. Order this mug. Especially if you're in the United States, it's actually a pretty good value. I've got very, very little markup. I think we make $2 or $3 a mug. But look at all the other stuff, and then yeah, that's all we've got. If you want to support us monetarily and you don't want to shop online in a store, then you can send donations. You can send support for the podcast to nearchurches@gmail.com, www.nearchurches@gmail.com. You can send the donation of any amount. Also, you can go to Substack, and you can subscribe for free. But if you want to support us through Substack, $5 a month. And then there's a platform called Patreon that we don't do anything on, but Patreon is a really good way. If you want to just set it and forget it, go to Patreon, www.christianitynow.com. Or www.patreon.com/ChristianityNow. Go there and give them your information, and they'll take $1 a month, and they'll do it until you tell them to stop. That's it. God bless you. Thank you so much. Podbean, Apple Podcast, Spotify, TuneIn Radio. Please subscribe and subscribe to the YouTube channel. And that's all we've got. God bless you, and we'll catch you on the flip side.